It's Sunday, June 21st. We're starting the day by looking at the political landscape J.D. Vance is navigating, the reality of the Cambodian cyber scam industry, and why the global AI monoculture is finally starting to crack. We've also got a look at the high-stakes transition happening in thoroughbred racing, and why the sports business world is currently a masterclass in managed chaos. Let's get into it. Section: National and World News. We're starting today with J.D. Vance's memoir, Communion. The book details his conversion to Catholicism and his stated permanent terror about life unraveling, which he says is why he is drawn to the church's hierarchy and historical continuity. It's an attempt to bridge his MAGA base with his religious life, which leads to some serious intellectual gymnastics. He spends portions of the book railing against meritocratic elites while simultaneously defending certain Russian positions. It's a classic case of trying to be everything to everyone, and it leaves both sides questioning his authenticity. If his political future depends on being the heir to Trump, this constant reincarnation might actually be the thing that keeps him from securing it. Moving over to Cambodia, we're seeing the real-world consequences of the global cyber scam industry. These are corporate-style enterprises operating out of fortified compounds, using human trafficking to build a massive, coerced labor force. The industry has been able to thrive because of deep-level corruption, with figures tied to the Cambodian government providing protection. But recent international pressure has forced a shift. Syndicate bosses have abandoned these compounds, releasing upwards of 200,000 workers. But here's the kicker. The government's response has been to treat these victims as criminals. Instead of providing help, they're hitting these destitute, former forced laborers with $10 a day visa overstay fines. It's a total disaster. These people are now stranded, unable to pay these fees, and the government's refusal to distinguish between victim and perpetrator is effectively pushing these survivors right back into the hands of the scammers who are looking to rebuild their workforce. Staying on international instability, the situation in the Middle East is looking increasingly fragile. The ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah has largely fallen apart, which is putting the U.S.-Iran talks, and by extension, the stability of global oil markets, on life support. Iran is holding the U.S. responsible for Israeli compliance. So as the fighting continues, the diplomatic framework the administration was relying on is essentially evaporating. At home, this is causing a real headache for the White House. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Roger Wicker and other hardline Republicans are pushing back, arguing that the administration's strategy is just trading away military leverage for empty promises. The White House hasn't been shy about calling these critics fools, but that kind of rhetoric is only making it harder to build the consensus they need. It's a tough spot. They're losing their diplomatic leverage abroad, while simultaneously burning bridges with the people they need to actually pass a budget or sustain a long-term policy. While that's happening, there's a quiet but potentially massive crisis brewing in the Democratic Republic of Congo. An Ebola outbreak is moving faster than the official response, and the data is looking shaky. Official government figures for contact tracing are being challenged by independent estimates that suggest a significant gap in coverage. Health infrastructure is failing, with workers actually becoming vectors for the virus because they lack basic PPE. If these suspected deaths near transit hubs like the Bunia Airport turn out to be Ebola, we're not looking at a local health issue anymore. We're looking at a regional security crisis. Finally, we're watching a shift in the Democratic Party through the lens of some key New York congressional primaries. We're seeing a move away from the identity-based politics that dominated the 2019-2020 cycle, toward a more policy-heavy, vision-driven platform. Candidates like Alex Bors are making a point to talk about things like AI regulation and an AI dividend to address labor displacement. He's arguing that the reason we don't have guardrails on AI isn't because voters don't want them. Polling shows 80% support, but because tech interests are dumping money into super PACs to keep things the way they are. We're also seeing candidates like Dalia Lisa Avila Chevalier challenging incumbents by linking local economic issues like housing to broader national foreign policy. They're arguing that the current Trump binary, relying on the fear of the opposition, is losing its juice. The takeaway here is pretty clear. Voters are looking for an affirmative vision that actually touches their wallets and their daily lives. If these insurgent campaigns manage to pull off wins, it's going to be a very loud signal to the party establishment that the status quo isn't just unpopular. It's becoming a liability they can no longer afford to keep. Speaking of tech, the AI landscape is shifting under our feet even faster than that. The AI industry is officially entering its get-out-of-jail-free phase. And by that, I mean businesses are finally realizing that putting all their eggs in one cloud-based basket is a massive liability. We're seeing a rapid shift away from relying on a single proprietary frontier model. Instead, companies are moving toward decentralized, multi-model architectures. The goal is simple: avoid platform risk. If your entire business model depends on a single API that could be nuked by a regulatory shift or a sudden provider outage, you're not a business, you're a hostage. The most interesting development here is the rise of high-performance open-weight models, specifically GLM 5.2. For a long time, open source was the budget option that couldn't keep up with the closed-source giants. According to practitioners like Jeremy Howard, GLM 5.2 is performing on par with leading proprietary systems. This is a big deal, because it gives organizations a reason to buy their own hardware. When you own the model and the metal, you don't have to worry about a cloud provider's terms of service changing overnight. It's a smart move, but let's be real, it's also a defensive one. We're also seeing model routing becoming the industry standard. Tools like the OpenRouter Fusion API act as a middleman, sending your prompt to multiple models and letting a judge model pick the best output. Originally, this was just about saving money on tokens. Now, it's a hedge against total system failure. If one provider goes dark, the router just swaps them out for another. It's basically a failover switch for the entire AI stack. Then, there's the geopolitical angle. G7 nations are scrambling to balance access to foreign frontier models with the need for sovereign AI, basically making sure they can build their own stuff so they don't have to rely on someone else's infrastructure. It's the end of the monoculture era. If you're still tied to one model, you're betting on a horse that might just decide to stop running. But while the tech is moving toward decentralization, our laws are still stuck in the mud. There's a massive tension right now between how we actually experience AI, which is local, and the fact that it runs on a national interconnected grid. Right now, we're stuck in a binary trap. If we leave regulation to local governments, it's a disaster. Local authorities don't have the subpoena power to look under the hood of these massive foundation models, so they can only regulate the edges. Plus, if every city or state writes their own rulebook, you create a compliance nightmare. Small startups get crushed by the legal fees, and states end up in a race to the bottom, weakening their own safety standards just to keep tech companies from moving to the next town over. On the flip side, a singular federal framework in Washington has its own problems. It might be efficient, but it's almost guaranteed to be disconnected from the actual specific harms communities face on the ground. A federal rule, drafted by people who think in abstracts, won't necessarily help a community dealing with biased local policing or specific healthcare failures. It's a classic infrastructure headache. The prevailing thought is that we're moving toward concurrent federalism. Think of it like the Clean Air Act. The feds set a baseline, a floor for protection, and then let states enforce stricter, more specific standards on top of that. It's messy, it's overlapping, and it's likely going to be a headache to manage. But it's probably the only way to govern a technology that is at the same time a global utility and a personal tool. Of course, all of this assumes we can actually catch the technology. With these powerful open-source models running on local personal hardware, we're moving outside the reach of traditional cloud oversight entirely. The data centers aren't the only game in town anymore, which honestly is probably for the best. When the infrastructure is everywhere, the old, centralized ways of controlling it start to look pretty outdated. the era of simple jurisdictional control is over, whether the regulators like it or not. And speaking of horses, the racing industry is facing its own set of outdated rules. Thoroughbred racing is in the middle of a messy, high-stakes transition. We're seeing a massive shift in the professional landscape, marked by the retirement of veterans like Corey Lannery after 35 years and over 5,000 wins. In his place, the sport is being consolidated by specialized agent networks and high-volume trainers who rely on rigorous, data-driven management. It's a trend that's effectively pricing out the hobbyist owner, forcing smaller operations to either scramble for regional stakes like the Ohio Derby or get pushed out of the game entirely. Honestly, it's the classic story of get big or get out. When you have trainers like Safi Joseph Jr. turning horse performance into a metrics-heavy science, it raises the barrier to entry so high that the average owner is left with a shitty choice. Settle for bottom-tier claiming horses or dump massive capital into stables that play by these new expensive rules. Then there's the regulatory side, specifically the HISA whip strike limit. The rule caps jockeys at 6 strikes, and the industry is split on the consequences. Regulators argue it's a necessary step for horse welfare and public perception, but participants are pushing back, arguing that the limit forces riders to spend their focus counting strikes instead of steering their horses. The concern is that this creates a dangerous distraction during high-intensity moments, potentially triggering more accidents. For riders at smaller tracks, a 3-day suspension for a technical violation isn't just a slap on the wrist, it's a direct hit to their livelihood. The industry is also struggling with how to keep the lights on. Tracks are caught in a tug-of-war between branding themselves through high-purse marquee events and funding their daily bread-and-butter races. Supporters like trainer Dale Romans argue that signature derbies are vital funnels for new fans, but these splashy events often cannibalize the daily purse pool that smaller barns depend on to survive. Some tracks, like Canterbury, are trying to bridge the gap by offering free data to casual bettors, but that's an expensive gamble that doesn't always pay off for smaller venues. It's a fragile ecosystem, and history shows that being good at the job isn't enough to save you. Look at the old Miles Park in Kentucky. Despite millions in upgrades and a successful stint as a proving ground for talent like Earl Fires, it was eventually gutted when the State Racing Commission decided to consolidate dates elsewhere. The facility's history and operational agility didn't matter once the regulators decided it didn't fit their master plan. It's a stark reminder that in this industry, you're only as safe as your last regulatory approval. Whether it's the shift toward data-heavy training or the consolidation of racing dates, the people running the show are clearly prioritizing top-down systemic stability over the chaotic, community-focused grassroots that actually gave the sport its soul in the first place. That same regulatory failure and consolidation is defining the current state of college sports too. The SEC is moving to a 9-game conference schedule in 2026, a shift that is set to fundamentally change the competitive landscape of the sport. College sports has officially entered a state of permanent, managed chaos. The NCAA has effectively lost its teeth, and since it can't actually police its own membership anymore, schools are just running to the courthouse whenever they don't like a rule. Take the Brendan Sorsby case. A single legal injunction against an eligibility ruling has basically set a precedent that threatens the integrity of the whole system. Conferences are now acting as their own enforcement bodies. Let's be honest, is a recipe for disaster. The Big Ten and the SEC are the only ones really calling the shots, effectively acting as a duopoly that keeps the rest of the sport in a state of suspended animation. They use the threat of a breakaway Super League as a bargaining chip whenever they need to get their way, but they're too busy fighting over playoff structures to actually build anything coherent. It's a messy, profitable, and fundamentally unstable ecosystem that isn't going anywhere, mainly because everyone involved is making too much money to walk away. With that new 9-game schedule, the betting markets are going to be turned upside down. It's no longer just about who has the better players. It's about who has the roster depth to survive a war of attrition. You're looking at teams like Mississippi State, who are likely to be physically outmatched on the line of scrimmage in almost every game, making their win total under look like a pretty safe play. Meanwhile, Programs like Texas A&M and Oklahoma are positioned to capitalize, built with the defensive identities and roster depth that actually hold up in a grinded-out schedule. Texas, on the other hand, is walking into an absolute buzzsaw of a schedule, and the smart money is betting their win total or their playoff spot doesn't survive the meat grinder. In the NBA, the Utah Jazz are currently playing a game of fiscal chicken with their own roster. They're hesitant to hand out a massive top-tier center contract to Walker Kessler, given his health history, and frankly, they're right to be. By keeping their offers in the $28 million range, they're prioritizing long-term flexibility over short-term sentimentality. It's a cold way to run a front office, but if they want to build a real contender rather than just a collection of talented parts, they have to stop overpaying for guys who can't get on the floor. Finally, the Brooklyn Nets are staring down a pivotal offseason with a massive pile of cap space and the 6th overall pick. They need to stop chasing theoretical upside and start acquiring actual, proven talent to provide some structure for their younger players. If they waste their time reaching for prospects based on lazy comparisons to past stars, they're just going to spend another year in the wilderness. The move here is using their draft assets to buy undervalued players already sitting on other teams' benches, rather than hoping some rookie magically turns into a franchise cornerstone overnight. With the world feeling this disjointed, it's worth taking a beat to look at how we manage our own mental bandwidth. A recent guest on the show discussed the idea that personal growth isn't about collecting degrees or external data, but about shedding the ego. The argument is that humans are essentially extensions of the universe, and when we act like isolated individuals, we create artificial limitations. The move here is to stop viewing failure as a character flaw and start seeing it as a temporary misalignment with the natural order. Which honestly sounds like a hell of a lot less work than the standard shame spiral most of us live in. Then there's the issue of mental clutter. A report on leadership suggests that unmade decisions function exactly like high-interest debt. When you dodge a tough call, like firing that underperformer or pulling the plug on a project, your brain keeps that loop open, draining the bandwidth you actually need for strategy. It's a classic case of paying the interest on your own hesitation, while your actual work sits in the gutter. The fix is a bias for immediate closure, which stops the bleeding and lets you move on to the next problem before it festers. Finally, retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling is pushing for parents to start building an ethical will for their kids. The idea is to document your own failures and values, so your children don't have to reinvent the wheel when it comes to character. Hertling notes that we obsess over grades and status, but treat character as some vague afterthought, which leaves kids flying blind through their own moral hurdles. By sharing where you screwed up, you're not just giving them a roadmap. You're stripping away the performative bullshit that makes every generation think they're the first to ever fail. It's essentially treating your past as data, rather than something you need to hide to look perfect. And before we wrap, a few quick things to keep on your radar. A few other things worth knowing today. First, David Senra is pointing out that when big companies get lazy because they own the distribution channels, they start peddling absolute garbage. That's the opening for smaller, agile shops to come in and eat their lunch, simply by caring about the product again. In the world of international football, the TIFO guys are stressing that winning tournaments isn't about some grand, perfect tactical vision. It's about being pragmatic enough to dial back the intensity when you need to. Because playing at a sprint for 90 minutes is a great way to blow your squad's legs out before the final. Over in the NBA, the Knicks are proving you don't need to mortgage your entire future for a superstar to be a contender. They've built a legitimate threat by prioritizing defensive discipline and high basketball IQ over the usual collect-all-the-draft-pick strategy, which honestly is a hell of a lot more sustainable. And finally, if you think you're diversified because you hold 5 different ETFs, check the fine print. You're likely just buying the same handful of tech stocks 5 times over, which is a shitty way to manage your retirement risk when the market decides to take a dump. That's the briefing for June 21st. See you tomorrow.